You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. And hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
WFP calls on all sides of the conflict to allow food and humanitarian aid to reach the most vulnerable in Yemen, wherever they are in all 22 governorates.
A ceasefire in Yemen, at least until the end of Ramadan. My guests Jane Kinnamont and James Boyes will look at whether there's any hope of prolonging peace beyond that, as well as discussing the day's other big stories, including Greece's proposals for keeping itself in the euro. Will they be sufficient? And if they are, who has blinked at whom? We'll also consider the legacy of the world's longest-serving foreign minister, Prince Saud Al Faisal of Saudi Arabia, who has died aged 78. And
I am not and will not be afraid to keep fighting for common sense reforms and, along with you, achieve those on behalf of all who have been lost because of this senseless gun violence in our country.
Might gun control in America be an idea whose time has come at last? Or is Hillary Clinton just picking a fight she can't win but won't lose? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Jane Kinnamont, Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and James Boyes, historian and author, most recently of Clinton's Grand Strategy. Welcome both back to the show. And we will start tonight with Greece, which now appears to be offering to submit to a regime of austerity arguably more severe than the one its people rejected by an overwhelming margin in last Sunday's referendum, leaving bewildered creditors and observers alike wondering whether Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras is a genius playing a game so deep nobody but him can see it, or a grandstanding gadabout who hasn't the least idea what he's actually doing. Jane, what do we imagine has been said to Greece in quiet corners between Sunday evening and last night?
Well, it's quite clear publicly that an immense amount of pressure has been put on Greece and threats almost to make it into a failed state, a country that's unable to access medicines, cash, etc. You'd be forgiven for thinking that you were talking about Iran, but no, it's Greece. It's just fascinating to see if Tsipras will be able to get this past his party and his supporters, who presumably thought they were voting for something quite different very recently.
James, it is a bizarre spectacle in any number of respects. We have seen this week the prospect being raised of humanitarian aid for Greece, a 21st century first world country and a member of the European Union. People are, I think observers, myself not least among them, are so completely confused by what's going on that no one seems to quite understand which side has buckled. Have you figured it out?
Answers on a postcard, quite frankly, Andrew. Do most people not know what on earth's going on, when people were talking about the referendum last weekend and people were saying, well, they vote yes or no, I'm not sure how many people quite understood whether a yes vote was a good thing or the no vote was a good thing, the way things were getting banded around. Quite frankly, you know, the amount of people I was seeing being interviewed within the Greek community, and they hadn't got a clue what was best for them, for their country, for the long-term strategy for the Europeans. You know, is it better to remain in and keep battling, or is it better to sort of step away from this and try and rectify this and perhaps with a view to rejoining in the future? But at the moment, it's just an absolute utter mess, quite frankly. It's very difficult to see how on earth this is going to resolve itself. The Greek people, I think, thought that they were getting, you know, here it is, the origins of democracy itself. They're getting the vote, they've been asked to vote, their vote has been counted, and it looks like it could count for naught.
James utters there to me what at least is the dread phrase of Greece stays in and keep battling. And I just say this from a selfish perspective because I, like most of the media, ran out of jokes, puns and allegories to Greek fable about 2.5 years ago. And we are going to have to go around again if this keeps up. If some sort of deal is done, What I don't understand, and what I don't think anyone else understands, is how is it possible that we won't be having this conversation again 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, a year from now?
I assume that's exactly what is going to be happening.
There's
a large number of successive payments that Greece owes. It seems quite a likely scenario that if they reach compromise now, they will continue negotiating on possible debt restructuring or slowdown of payments of the next lot of payments that come to, and there will continue probably to be a lot of domestic difficulties within Greece deciding on the kind of terms that they would accept, what compromises they would make. So I think this is going to be a very long-running saga.
There have been reports from inside Greece, and I'll put this to you, James, of Greeks furiously buying up, or Greeks who can still afford to buy up anything, buying up high-end consumer items, largely because they don't really know what currency they might be spending or saving next week, and whether their savings will still be worth anything. There is, of course, precedent. There's reasons for their concerns. In 2013, we saw the frankly remarkable spectacle of Cyprus helping itself to a fair whack of bank accounts over 100,000 euros, nearly 50% over 100,000 euros. So going out and spending what money you have, is this actually prudent behaviour, or is it Greece rather demonstrating that, you know, they haven't quite got the message?
I don't think anybody would describe it as prudent, quite frankly. It's classic panic buying. It's buy now because you don't know whether what you're going to have in the bank will be worth anything, quite frankly, in the future. And that's if you can get access to your banks. The banks have been closed, don't forget, for the last couple of days. So it's a very frightening experience, I think, if you are in that position. I mean, I think the three of us, if we can agree on nothing else, it's that thank goodness we're not Greek at the moment, quite frankly, because that would be
this is the thing that, yeah, we should not lose sight of. For your actually ordinary Greek people, this must be terrifying.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think we should focus on that just a little bit, because we can talk about, you know, the high-level stakes and what this means for the euro and for the European currency and for people in Brussels. But, you know, if for your average Greek citizen, this is an absolute nightmare. You know, you've worked hard all your life, and now all of a sudden you can't get access to your own money, and you're going out having to buy material things that you might not necessarily need, but you think, well, if I don't buy it now, I can't buy it tomorrow. So, you know, I think fundamentally the reason that the Greek is not going to be kicked out and that this is going to keep ticking along, I think it's ultimately that, you know, this is a project which is too big to allow to fail. Because if Greece is allowed to exit, who else is next? You know, where's the next crisis going to come from? Spain, Portugal,
Italy.
You know, Italy, you've got it.
I mean, which leads me to my next question, Jane. And I mean, it's something that certainly Syriza were full of this time last week, that they really did play, obviously, quite successfully the underdog card of like poor struggling Greece being beaten up on by the big bad EU, ECB and IMF. But given the concerns that Spain, Italy, other one or two other slightly wobbly economies might be encouraged by Greece exiting the euro to follow them, do you think that maybe Syriza were not entirely incorrect, that there is a desire on the part of the big, I guess, founder EU powers to punish Greece, to make an example of them, to say that you have to play by the rules or this is what you can face yourself with?
There absolutely is. And for example, the German government would say that openly, but they would put it in terms of moral hazard, i.e. if we don't create a deterrent, we'll encourage other countries to spend too much and default on their debt. But the tactics being employed probably are going to backfire, at least in the eyes of some. YouGov have just done quite an interesting poll where they were showing the variety of opinions across different countries. But in France, about as many people think that the EU and Greece are equally to blame as actually think that Greece holds the blame for this. When you see people forced into panic buying, unable to access their banks, terrified about their pensions and so forth, it does awaken sympathy in a lot of people and fears about the power that the EU institutions have today.
Well, okay, on the assumption that this won't be the last time we're discussing Greece in the immediate future, let's move along and take a look at Yemen. It's a country which has spent this year edging towards complete collapse, consumed by a war between government forces and rebels, beleaguered by the predations of Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, and bombed from the air to debatable effect by a coalition of air forces led by Saudi Arabia. In a much-needed respite for Yemen's actual people, 80% of whom are estimated by the UN to require humanitarian assistance, a ceasefire will begin today and is scheduled to last until the end of Ramadan, a week or so hence. James, do we think the ceasefire will hold? They had a five-day one in May, or at least a fairly one-sided one in May, which did sort of hold.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, you know, when you get these situations arising, you know, you can only hope. And I don't want to sound like, you know, I'm suddenly sounding like someone who I think I'd be mistaken for. I'm talking about, you know, the Greek people and their tragic situation. Now all of a sudden I'm talking about the tragedy of the people on the ground in Yemen. This idea, I think, that, you know, it is too easy to lose sight of the human tragedy in all this. And I think one can only hope that when, you know, these ceasefires are announced, that the powers that be can give the people on the ground some respite and allow them to follow their faith accordingly.
Jane, the parties who are permitting this ceasefire, are they acting from purely altruistic and humanitarian impulse, or do either or both of them see a military logic to the idea of giving it a rest for a week as well?
I think it largely reflects international pressure on Saudi Arabia to create another humanitarian pause. The US finds itself in a very difficult position here. It's actually deeply concerned about what Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen. Not just the humanitarian impact, but the possibility that the main beneficiary will in the end be Al-Qaeda. But the Saudis are their allies, and they don't want to speak up publicly against their allies or even indeed stop selling them arms.
We will be talking more about the world's reluctance to speak up against the Saudis fairly shortly. James... this is a very complicated and very peculiar conflict at a number of levels. But from the Saudis' perspective, has their air campaign, which they launched in March, demonstrably accomplished actually anything from purely in terms of whatever it was they might have set out to achieve?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to ascertain at this point, I think, exactly how effective it has been. Could things have been worse? Distinct possibility. I think when you talk about the idea that we are now going to have, you know, some sort of a truce, it might be an opportunity to sort of get some idea about measuring exactly what it is that has occurred, to try and get some sort of observation that we could try and measure, you know, where things are now, where things were, and during this sort of what will no doubt be a brief respite to try and get a sense of what has been accomplished. But I dare say that the way things are going, it looks very unlikely that a great deal has been achieved that will be sustainable, I guess, in the long term.
Jane, among the parties still dictating terms or has been involved in establishing the terms of this ceasefire is, of course, Yemeni's President Adrabah Mansour Hadi, who hasn't actually set foot in his own country now for some weeks. He is in exile in Saudi Arabia. Is this a blind alley still involving him? I mean, I know he is president and the UN Security Council has passed a resolution reminding everybody that he's president, but... everybody else saying your president's not the same as being president. Does he still actually seriously matter?
Very questionable. Of course, he is the internationally recognised president, and that matters. And the Saudis have thrown their weight behind him, calling him the symbol of legitimacy and all of these things. We need to remember he was actually only meant to be in power for a transitional period before there were to be elections in Yemen. So his position shouldn't become a major sticking point because he's not meant to be a ruler who is there for many years. Many people say his deputy, Baha, is much better liked, but there's going to be problems for any of the government in exile the longer the time they spend outside the country.
Do you think, though, just to follow that up, that maybe the world needs to get past assuming or thinking of Yemen as a single coherent whole? It hasn't always been the case. In fact, it's only been one country since, I think, the mid-90s,
hasn't
it? That's
right.
Is the kind of political logic and the facts on the ground dictating towards a repartition of Yemen, and would it not be more constructive to talk about how maybe that could be managed?
It's very likely, even before this current crisis, they were talking about some kind of radical decentralisation. And probably one of the reasons this Houthi militia started to escalate on the ground is they thought the country was going to be carved up into different powerful provinces, and they wanted their bit to be bigger, with more natural resources. Whether or not there's some formal recognition of decentralisation or even separation in Yemen, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult for anyone to really exercise central control of the country.
And James, is there just a final thought on this before we move on to other things after the break? Is there a role for any outside power here? America would be the obvious one, or has the United States now just got irretrievably to the point of thinking about involvement in Middle Eastern wars the same way it thinks about involvement in anti-communist crusades in Southeast Asian jungles?
It's a beautifully phrased question. I think that... I think the United States has a recognized role to play in this part of the world. And I think this administration has gotten very much involved. I mean, we were talking before we came on air about the role the United States is playing with regards to Iran at this point. I just think that under Barack Obama, he recognizes that there was a very different role for America to play than perhaps someone like George W. Bush might have, that various candidates are positioning themselves vis-a-vis the rest of the world.
And final thought on this from you, Jane, and I'm allowing an opportunity for optimism to flourish here. Is there any hope at all that this ceasefire may persist beyond Eid al-Fitr, which I think is about a week away?
Only if there was some diplomatic breakthrough at the same time, either in the UN talks among the Yemeni factions, or perhaps even something coming out of the Iran nuclear talks that might say there's going to be an attempt to build a broader regional peace between Iran and its Gulf neighbours. But now I think we're really delving into extreme optimism, which probably isn't appropriate.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Jane Kinnan-Mont and James Boyce. Coming up next, the death of Prince Saud Al-Faisal, the world's longest-serving foreign minister, and Hillary Clinton puts a hand on one of American politics' third rails.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska's state ferry system afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Jane Kinnan-Mont and James Boyce. Riyadh has confirmed the death of Prince Saud Al-Faisal, aged 78. When he retired as Saudi Arabia's foreign minister 2 months ago, he was the longest-serving holder of such an office in the world, having represented the kingdom abroad for 40 years. Jane, an uncharitable view of the late prince, and why not, would just hold that he was the chief global emissary of one of the world's very worst regimes. Is there more of a case to be made for him?
Interestingly, over the time that he was in office, Saudi Arabia positioned itself as a real status quo power with a very pro-American foreign policy. At the same time, you've always had accusations, sometimes warranted, of them supporting jihadi, violent, sometimes terrorist groups overseas, although often that's something that will have come out of intelligence services rather than the foreign ministry. Here, you've seen a foreign policy oriented towards the US, and in latter years even making a kind of quiet and secret peace with Israel.
I mean, but just to follow that up, have the Saudis actually been diplomatically clever, and has he been diplomatically clever, or is it just a question of sauntering through life in the assumption that everyone's just going to keep grovelling to you because you've got lots of oil?
Well, they have their advantages. they have the resources, and they have a lot of money, which they've deployed through a great deal of checkbook diplomacy. You've seen this recent cache of WikiLeaks Saudi foreign ministry documents highlighting some of that. But it is also a country where you have a lot of people that are very, very anti the US. It could have played a very different role in the region. And it's interesting that it went for such a conservative status quo role. over most of the past four decades, we now have a somewhat more unpredictable Saudi Arabia, still absolutely needs the US, but as we were just talking about with Yemen, taking on some, you might charitably say, daring, perhaps also non-strategic and militaristic stances in a region that already has a lot of conflict to deal with.
James, US Secretary of State John Kerry has issued the toe-curling statement customary in such circumstances. He said Prince Saud has not just been the planet's longest-serving foreign minister, but also among the wisest. I mean, does America have to keep pretending they like them? I mean, can't they? I mean, everybody knows what the basis of this relationship is.
Well, maybe not for that much longer. I mean, who knows? I mean, one of the interesting things, I was out in that part of the world just over a year ago, and the great question over the future direction of US foreign policy in that world is going to come down to questions of energy interdependence for the United States. You know, the extent to which, you know, I think there already is too much of focus, quite frankly, based on the idea that US foreign policy is totally governed by oil. I think that's far too overstated. But as America becomes more energy independent through an awful lot of policies which were put in place actually by Barack Obama's much unloved predecessor, George W. Bush, I think the extent to which it needs to owe such deference to Saudi Arabia will become diminished. But I think the idea that Saudi Arabia and the United States have common strategic interests in that part of the world with regard to certain other countries, perhaps maybe we could talk about Israel, Iran, Iraq, for example, will, I think, necessitate a prolonged relationship, although perhaps not one of quite such deference.
Just to follow up on that before we move on to other things, it is, I mean, however realistic a view you take of the world, and you know the Palmerstonian dictum that nations have only permanent interests, not permanent friends or enemies, it is difficult to imagine outside North Korea a more definitively un-American regime than the one that obtains in Riyadh. Mm-hmm. Why has the American people, do you think, been so patient with that relationship? Because there's never been any significant pushback domestically.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure that your average American is spending an awful lot of time, Andrew, thinking about the relationship with Saudi Arabia. I think there's a lot of other things to worry about, quite frankly, if you're an American, and a lot of other countries that they give priority of thought to. I think this is something which occurs within the corridors of Washington, D.C., and I think the reason it has maintained that relationship is because of the long-standing relationships, for example, that, for example, the only recently departed U.S. Ambassador from Saudi Arabia, for example, was so close to the United States that, you know, they called him Bandar Bush at one point because he would he'd been in position for so long and you know, had established such good working relationships with consecutive American administrations. And fundamentally, a lot of that relationship, I think, does come down to that sort of a one-on-one relationship basis.
And Jane, finally, in Saudi Arabia, a new foreign minister has, of course, followed a new king. Are we learning anything definite yet about the direction Saudi Arabia may take in the next few years? You talked of it as a great status quo power. Is the status quo what they will seek to maintain?
The new foreign minister was previously an ambassador to the US, Adel Joubert, a non-royal, and that's sending a signal that that relationship with the US is still key. But the most powerful people in the country are now younger generation royals, including the son of the king, who's in his 30s, who has surprised most of the world with this bombing campaign in Yemen. And so there is an element of unpredictability and a lot of questions being asked in Saudi Arabia about what changes might come as the world energy market changes and as Iran seems to be getting quite close to a deal with the rest of the world.
Okay, well, finally tonight, it's been accepted political wisdom in the United States for about as long as the states have been united that there's little yardage, especially at presidential level, in campaigning against guns. A few weeks ago, however, the same might have been said about campaigning against the flying of the Confederate battle flag outside southern capitals. Hillary Clinton, sensing that last month's massacre at Charleston's Emanuel AME Church might have shifted more than one tectonic plate, has added lines on tougher gun laws to her stump speech. James, is this, Democrats traditionally have gone out of their way to have themselves, like, always at some point in the campaign, they're photographed blazing away at local bird life so they can look like they're proper red-blooded gun-toting Americans and not sort of sandal-wearing liberal panty waists, etc., etc. Is Hillary running any kind of risk here?
Well, let me tell you exactly what she is doing. First of all, you need to think about where she's speaking. Okay, so this is in Iowa and New Hampshire, which is not the South. They can be the first votes.
Still not unkeen on guns in Iowa and New Hampshire, though.
That's true, but there is a very different culture, I think, in the North than in the South. It's the first states that are going to vote. And what she is doing very carefully, I think, is recognizing the potential threat she faces, not from a Republican at this point, but from the left of the Democratic Party, from someone like Bernie Sanders, for example, who has gone very, very well in recent weeks in positioning himself as a true liberal alternative to the de facto rather conservative Hillary Clinton frontrunner. And she, I think, is trying to inoculate herself here because Bernie Sanders has got a weak record on gun control legislation. He doesn't talk in favor of it, in fact, quite the opposite. So I think she is trying to find a leverage issue here where she can come in and be more liberal than Bernie Sanders on an issue and can paint him as rather conservative and also say that the only administration in recent years which has done any terms of gun control was the Clinton administration in the first term when they brought the Brady Bill in.
Which Bill Clinton later said cost Al Gore the election in 2000.
There's no doubt about it that what Al Gore ran was a very poor campaign
it
in 2000,
indeed.
And he could and should have won that campaign quite handily.
Jane, are we buying Hillary's sincerity here, which is always a bit of a question with the Clintons? She was fairly quiet about this in 2008 when running for president, apart from when she piled in on Obama after he made his perhaps ill-judged remark about bitter people clinging to God and guns, a remark which, while ill-judged, was probably not inaccurate. I mean, is it possible to see a genuine shift in America and about its relationship with guns in the same way we have seen a fairly, quite extraordinary shift, if a symbolic one, in its relationship with the stars and bars?
I don't see that happening at a national level. I think it's another of these issues around which American politics and society is very deeply polarised. There's a whole swathe of the electorate that just won't buy this, but clearly she is calculating that this will appeal to the base and that it makes her look brave, and that perhaps for a younger generation of Democratic supporters who aren't political insiders, this is something to say, well, yes, actually, why can't we change something that we've been told for so long as a political red line?
I mean, also, James, I guess, and I don't wish to sound like I'm disagreeing with the idea of tougher gun laws in America because, you know, I like to think of myself as basically sane. But might Hillary also be, as well, you know, if we take her sincerity for granted here, might she also be calculating that she can't lose, can she, by picking a fight with the NRA? They hate her anyway. Mm-hmm. They're not going to vote for her. It's an easy win for her, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, the NRA will be supporting the Republican Party come the autumn November elections of 2016, whoever that Republican nominee is.
Well, even if it's Donald Trump?
Even if it's Donald Trump, because they have nowhere else to go, quite frankly. And if it's Jeb Bush, for them, so much the better, quite frankly. I think the big problem that Hillary Clinton faces, quite frankly, is that whilst it's very easy to sit here in Europe and think, well, clearly, and I'm paraphrasing you, it's only nutters who want more guns on the streets. One of the benefits I have from where I work at the university is it's a very diverse culture, and we get an awful lot of Americans, for example, from all parts of the country, many from New England, for example. And, you know, we get young female Americans who would vote Democrat who say categorically, you know what, I'll vote Democrat every day, but I like my gun. It's a Second Amendment right under the Constitution, and as long as that Constitution is in place, if the bad guys have got guns, I want guns. It's just a different political culture, and it's not something which is always explained very well here by people who read The Guardian and drink their latte, I don't think. No offence, personally, I assure you.
Jane, very final brief thought from you on this. Do you think gun control is actually going to be a presidential issue, or is this just it's this week's story, so here's a presidential candidate saying something about it?
I think it's part of a package of identity politics in an increasingly polarised American election debate.
Jane Kinnamont and James Boyes, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for. Today's Midori House was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Henry Rhys Sheridan and Mariana Zuniga. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Josh Fennett is here with Monocle's International Playlist. 1900 Hours, Marcus Hippie is in with the menu. At 2200 is the Monocle Daily. I think I'm right in saying with Emma Nelson and Paul Osborne. Midori House returns this time on Monday, also hosted by me. But for now, thanks for listening and have a good weekend.